Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. And joining me for the roundtable this week, we have Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hey, great to be here.
Ohio Capital Journal reporter Megan Henry. Welcome back, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And Hannah News Service reporter Shane Stegmiller. Welcome back, Shane.
Thank you for inviting me back.
And property owners are wondering if and when tax relief is coming. The General Assembly last month passed a controversial plan that they said would provide relief. Governor DeWine didn't like their plan and vetoed it. Now lawmakers in the House say they will return next week, intent to override three of the governor's property tax vetoes. Jeremy, how unusual is it for lawmakers to return from a summer recess to try to hold a vote?
It's certainly not unprecedented, and it seems this for the past few years, there's always something going on in the summer that's fairly unanticipated, either a special election or, in this case, a veto override. And it's not completely unusual for lawmakers to come back and override things. In this particular instance, this is the Ohio House that really wanted to pass these things, and these property tax measures come as Ohioans and homeowners around the state have seen their property tax bills rise by, I think it's 19-20% on average over the past few years. So this is not coming out of nowhere. This is out of lawmakers on both sides of the aisle wanting to find actual ways to reduce homeowners' gripes about seeing their property tax bills go up.
Now, Shane, the governor vetoed 67 things, but they have decided to hone in on three of his vetoes to try to override them. Property taxes are complicated, but could you explain which three provisions they are trying to override?
So they're planning on taking up three of them. The first one involves these county budget commissions that are made up of not many people know about them, but it's like the county auditor, the county treasurer, the county prosecutor. They, whenever you get a levy, they kind of look at it and certify different parts of it. What this item would do is, so the county budget commission, it verifies all tax levies that are properly authorized and allocated and to determine the annual property tax rates for each taxing authority. And see, what the budget did was it gave these little-known county budget authorities, which each county budget authority kind of did things a little differently, so they weren't kind of uniform in what they do. This kind of gives them a little more power. This kind of gives them the power to look at, you know, this is a fixed rate levy that you have put on the ballot and that voters approved, but you're getting much, much more than what voters approved for this fixed rate. So this would give them the power to look at that and say, no, you're getting way much more money than what you told voters you were going to be getting out of this, and allow them to adjust it downwards.
Okay, so the lawmakers wanted to do that, and DeWine said, no, let's not do that. So he vetoed that.
Yeah, he said it gives them the authority to unilaterally reduce a levy passed by voters for a school district or other tax authorities. And he said that it breaches the approval of what voters passed.
The part, Megan, the part of the property tax issue that everyone was talking about was this carryover thing. So there was this idea that the House wanted school districts to only be able to carry over 30%. The Senate said they could carry over 50%. The compromise committee settled on 40%. And it seems like did the governor leave that alone, or what happened with that?
I'm going to.
You're going to defer to Jeremy. Yeah.
He vetoed that as well.
Okay. He also vetoed something that would end replacement and emergency property tax levies. Mm-hmm. I mean, the upshot about this is property taxes are really complex. Mm-hmm. And lawmakers have been trying to find ways to basically rein in the power of local governments, which are the ones, school districts, local governments for things like police departments and libraries and things like that. They're the ones who charge property taxes, and lawmakers are trying to find ways to rein in the power of local governments to charge property taxes going forward.
Okay.
But the upshot is that these things, if they override the governor's veto, would rein in the power of local governments to impose and increase property taxes. However, local governments are saying, well, okay, if you do this to us, we're going to have to go back to voters and seek other tax hikes and go back to the ballot and raise taxes on other things. So it's not like, well, we'll just cut taxes and that's the end of it. So this is an ongoing debate between state and local officials about local officials' property tax powers.
Now, Matt Huffman is the speaker, and he's calling members of the House back. Next week is the date he set. Does that mean that he thinks he has enough votes to override? What does he need?
Well, he needs a 60% in the House and mm-hmm. in the Senate. So the House does it first. So that means at least 60 out of the 99 House members. And then you got to go to the Senate, where you also need a 60% of the 33 member Senate to pass it. Obviously, the fact that they scheduled it means that they think they have it. But, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know if they created a giant doodle poll or something. But there's a lot of summer vacations that lawmakers are taking. And, you know, there's some scheduled medical procedures and things like that. So it sounds like they have it. But, you know, obviously, you know, we'll see if something unexpected happens.
Well, and because the budget is a House bill, the House is the one who has to start this process of overriding the vetoes. The Senate can't just take this up willy-nilly without the House acting mm-hmm. first on it.
Now, school officials loudly oppose this plan, that would require certain districts to return money to property tax owners. That was that whole 40% thing I was mentioning. So it was the school districts who were speaking out. They were getting people to basically write to the governor, email the governor. So was it that the governor heard them loud and clear and said what Ohio lawmakers were trying to do was just too much?
He was worried of the what it would do to the bottom line of a lot of these school districts. And I mean, there's the argument that you're punishing schools for being good stewards of taxpayer money and you know, holding money back in case they don't, you know, they need it for a future day. He did veto the 40%, and I will note that this is not one of the 40% carryout. He vetoed it. But it's not one of the three veto overrides that they're planning on taking up. However, that could happen later. And in the announcement that Huffman put out saying we're coming back on this day, there is a note in there that says we could possibly take up other vetoes later.
And can we talked about this last week on the roundtable, and one of the reporters was talking about the timing. So basically, when do they need to override a veto by? Why are they coming next week? Jeremy, do you know, is this a rush? I'm not sure.
I don't know if it's a rush. It's done out of a feeling that if they don't pass this by September, these changes won't take an effect for the next year's property tax bills. Mm-hmm. And also, I feel that there's just a lot of annoyance and anger among many lawmakers who were involved in this, that they want to strike while the iron's hot. They don't want to just sort of dilly-dally and wait till September or whenever to pass these. They're pissed now, and they want to override the governor's vetoes now.
In another twist, though, the air conditioning in the House is being replaced, so the members won't be meeting in the House chamber. I mean, not that that matters, but I thought that was a random twist.
You can insert your own joke about all the hot air at the State House.
So they're going to be meeting in the Senate chambers while the air conditioning is being repaired at the House. But one last thing on property taxes. Within the past week, Governor DeWine has also form some sort of tax reform working group. Shane, what is the goal of this group?
So when DeWine vetoed all of these items dealing with property taxes, that was one of his ways to kind of smooth over the edges that may make people mad, to make it look like, you know, he is doing something. So this is his way of saying, no, I am concerned about property taxes. Here's what I'm going to do. And he's putting together the study group, and he's, named some high profile people to help kind of lead this discussion, including former longtime lawmaker Bill Seitz, and also Pat Teaberry, who's a former Congress member and now the leader of the Ohio Business Roundtable.
Well, they've been working to try to fix property taxes for a long time. Can this working group fix it? What do you think?
We'll find out. I mean, this is something out of a classic DeWine playbook.
Yeah.
You put a blue ribbon panel in charge of coming up with recommendations. I mean, the legislature had a property tax reform group, and they basically they couldn't come to any real agreement about direction forward. They just kind of put everyone's recommendations in the report, and then they said, oh, well, if you pass all of these, some of these contradict each other, but we are just going to put everyone's thoughts in. It's a tough issue. It's a tough issue, again, because you are trying to balance people's property tax bills and their real concerns about seeing their bills jump with local governments making sure that they have enough money. I'm talking about school districts, mm-hmm. not just, cities and villages and things like that, but making sure schools and libraries and police departments on the local level have enough money to do their jobs.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. With us is Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal, and Shane Stegmiller from Hanna News Service. I wanted to jump to the Cleveland Browns Stadium, which has become a weekly topic on the reporter roundtable. It seems like there's always something new when it comes to the Browns trying to build a new stadium. The latest update this time, as promised, the plan to use unclaimed funds is headed to court. So a lawsuit has been filed by former Attorney General Mark Dan and a former Democratic representative, Jeff Crossman. Jeremy, can you tell us about why they are taking the Browns' plan to court, the plan to use unclaimed funds? Why are they taking that to court?
Right. So under the budget, the state will do something called escheat, which is basically seize money in this $4.8 billion, unclaimed property fund going forward. There's a 10-year grace period, but after that, after 10 years, any money in this fund will just revert to the state if it's not claimed. This is a good time to note that if you want to see if you have any unclaimed funds, you can go to unclaimedfunds.ohio.gov. I know I looked the other day and I had some money in there, so can't hurt to look. But what this lawsuit challenges is that by seizing that money, the state is violating the U.S. Constitution, its rights of due process, and taking private property without just compensation, and that it also violates the Ohio Constitution's guarantees against seizing private property. There's other stuff in there about, breaching the state's fiduciary duty and violating the single subject rule, so they're just kind of throwing the book at this to try to stop this.
Do you think if they were using the unclaimed funds to, fund education or build a bunch of new hospitals or something like that, would they be suing about it, or is it related because it's going to the Browns and other stadiums?
Well, if you read the lawsuit, it's as much of a political document as it is a legal document. Yeah. They make a lot of arguments about how unwise, in their opinion, the legislature was to do this, and also to give money to Democrats, not just Crossman and Dan, have opposed this, saying that why are we having the state help billionaires at the same time that we're looking to potentially cut Medicaid expansion for hundreds of thousands of people and to slash tax income taxes for people making six figures. And so this is in keeping with the Democratic platform about this budget and why they're critical of it.
And Megan, a whole lot of Ohioans have been working to get their hands on these unclaimed funds before it goes to stadiums. What do you know about that?
Yes. So in the month of June, more than 100,000 Ohioans started the process to get those unclaimed funds that Jeremy was mentioning. And June, of course, was when this was first added to the budget. And people started seeing headlines or started seeing the news about, oh, my unclaimed money could go towards this stadium and other stadium projects. And so a huge spike in folks starting the process to get their unclaimed funds, and I'm sure we'll see just more of that continue.
And just on a side note, Columbus Business First reported that a trust connected to Dee Haslam, who co-owns the Cleveland Browns and the Columbus Crew, along with her husband Jimmy, they bought a $25 million mansion recently in North Palm Beach. So they're doing just fine.
They also sold 10% of the Columbus Crew, which they also own, for about $90 million. So,
yeah. All right. Well, there's that. So we'll see. Where does the lawsuit go? When will we know something else about it?
Well, it's in Franklin County Court, and we'll see. Franklin County Court tends to be virtually all, if not all, of the judges on it are Democrats. So I wouldn't be surprised if they found some sympathy there. However, as it moves up the chain to the Ohio Supreme Court, if it ends up there, the Ohio Supreme Court is almost all Republican. So we'll see how much that is a factor in this lawsuit.
Can they not move forward? Can they not give out the money from the unclaimed funds until with a pending lawsuit?
I mean, if they issue some sort of injunction, then yes. Mm. Under the budget, that money is the first $1 billion is supposed to go out on January 1st.
Oh, okay. So we have some time.
There's some time, but we'll see if the court decides to put a wrench in that or not.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the latest with recreational marijuana, and we're going to talk about more money going to a defense contractor who's building a facility here in Central Ohio. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Summer is here. Join WOSU at family-friendly community events and festivals all summer long. For all dates and locations, visit our events page, wosu.org/events.
You're listening to All Sides and our weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with me, Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service, Megan Henry, reporter for Ohio Capital Journal, and Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Defense tech company Anduril Industries will get $310 million in the form of a grant. As a part of that agreement, the company says it will create 4,000 new jobs. It'll bring millions in state revenue. It'll bring millions in revenue to the state, rather. And the facility is being built in Pickaway County, which is it's near Rickenbacker International Airport. The total incentive package is worth millions more. So, Jeremy, what is Jobs Ohio planning to do here? They inked this deal. Can you explain the extra $310 million?
Yeah, this is actually a record for Jobs Ohio. This is more than twice the amount that Jobs Ohio gave to Intel for their $28 billion project out in by New Albany. And the reason is because if they follow through on their promises, the largest single job creation project in Ohio history. Like you said, more than 4,000 jobs promised, with an average salary, they're saying, of about $132,000 a year. And so there are clawback provisions in here, so that they would have to create and maintain those jobs over the next 30 years. Mm-hmm. And if not, the state could, or Jobs Ohio, rather, could grab some of this money back. This is down by Rickenbacker Airport. This comes on the heels. So if you add up all the state incentives for this project, this is for Anduril Industries, which is a high-tech weapons manufacturer out of California. They're going to make autonomous drones and things like that for the U.S. Department of Defense. And this comes along with a $452 million state tax credit that was approved back in January. The state's also going to give $86 million for infrastructure, like sewer lines and to build a taxiway from the airport over to the facility, things like that.
And Shane, this is a grant, right? So it doesn't have to be paid back. This is just money they get.
This is just money they get. And as Jeremy said, though, they have to meet certain incentives. So they have to create, you know, the jobs that they're promising to create. They have to also... you know, over the 30 years, they have to follow the rules of what comes with the grant.
All right. Well, I guess we'll talk about that again in 30 years, right? And see.
Put it on your calendar.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like such a weird thing to check on, to be like, okay, here's $310 million. We'll check back a couple decades from now and see if you held up your promises.
This is one of the reasons that Ohio officials actually extended the Jobs Ohio's lease of state liquor profits to do things like this. So now they have a hold on state liquor profits until 2053. And one of the reasons offered is, we need more time to be able to offer deals like this, you know, for decades to make sure that they're good for the money.
Hmm. All right, Megan, I want to move on to the Ohio ballot board last week blocked a proposed amendment from going forward that would remove Ohio's ban on gay marriage from the state constitution. Can you tell me what was decided and why?
Yeah, so essentially what happened is there was this proposed amendment that was before the Ohio ballot board, and it was decided in a party line vote by the Ohio ballot board that this is actually two amendments. One is to remove the gay marriage, the ban on same-sex marriage that is in the Ohio's constitution, which Ohio voters approved back in 2004. Of course, with the U.S. Supreme Court decision from 2015, the Obergefeller case that has prevented that from being in effect in Ohio, and so this would just remove that language if something were to happen to the Supreme Court case. But Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose basically said that there's that amendment, and then there is this separate amendment that would protect basically 12 classes in protecting citizens based on race, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, some language in there protecting essentially transgender Ohioans. And so he said these are two separate amendments. Ohioans could support removing the ban on same-sex marriage, but could not support basically any protections to all these different things. So basically it can go either go back to the drawing board of collecting signatures to get recertified through the Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost, or the group trying to put this forward could challenge this through the Ohio Supreme Court, which would be hard to do since it's mostly Republicans.
Hmm. I mean, with the way you describe it there, it does kind of sound like two different issues. Why did the group putting this forward want to put them together?
Their argument is that this all relates back to equality for all. And so equality for all Ohioans when it comes to who they marry, and also equality just protecting them, protecting Ohioans based on things of equality.
Yeah. So they haven't decided yet, though, if they're going to pursue, because they have to go regather all the signatures then to start, they have to start over.
They would, yes. And yes, as of last week, they said that they maybe have to decide with their legal team how they would move forward. As of this morning, I have not seen anything on decision of what they're going to do, either challenging it or try to get the initial signatures. Which I will say that they already did get the signatures for this original proposed amendment, but they'd have to go back and get them again, essentially.
Ohio's constitution includes this ban on same-sex marriage that passed in 2004. Are you hearing from the group? Do they think that that same ban would not pass today? And is it a different time, Jane?
They think that the winds have shifted, especially since Obergefell legalized same-sex marriage, and they do see it as a winning issue. One of the comments one of the representatives said is they almost kind of see them splitting out that part of it mm-hmm. as a sign that there is more support of it, and maybe there is some concern that by tying all this together, that's popular enough that it could take all the other stuff that maybe they don't like protecting all these classes, like the transgender protections, over the finish line. People will vote just to repeal that and also vote.
All right. So I guess this group is called Ohio Equal Rights, and they have to decide what to do next. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And I should note, they're trying to get on. They talked about a goal of getting on the 2026 ballot. And so they're not trying to get on this year's ballot. So they do have
Have time. Okay.
They have some time. However, it is quite the lengthy process to get on the ballot. As we're seeing here, there can be hiccups along the way.
And the deadline has passed in order to try and get on this year's ballot as well. Anyways,
I mean, the upshot here is that it's really so there's an initial 1,000 signatures and then they pass it. And if groups like the ballot board approve it, then they have to collect about 443,000 valid signatures. Mm-hmm. And in practice, because not all are valid, you have to usually collect a lot more than that. And the upshot is it's now really hard to do that just for one ballot issue, but now they would have to do it for two ballot issues to get everything they wanted. So as to why, another reason that they were seeking to do this is that they didn't have to get double the amount of signatures. They could just throw what they wanted to. Backers of this wanted to just throw everything to one and then get the signatures. So it effectively means that if they want to get everything they want, now they have to collect about almost 900,000 signatures to get everything on there. So it's just much harder.
Hmm. All right. Well, I wanted to also move on to another issue that came up. An appeals court last week ruled that the state can't stop cities like Columbus and Cleveland from enacting flavored tobacco bans. This is something that I had completely forgotten about. When it popped up on my phone, I was like, they're going to what now? So, Jeremy, can you give me a little background here? Are we allowed to have flavored tobacco? I'm confused.
I guess we'll find out. But in 2023, state lawmakers said, hey, local governments, you're not allowed to impose your own flavored tobacco bans or any tobacco restrictions that are more strict than what's in state law. And Columbus, Cleveland, and about 19, 20 other cities sued, saying, hey, this violates the Ohio Constitution's guarantee that we have home rule authority. And
so Columbus and Cleveland wanted to, is this like to dissuade young people from smoking if it tastes good or something like that?
Yeah, their argument is that flavored tobacco is, even if that it's specifically designed to, or even if it's not specifically designed, that it has a result of getting young people to get hooked on nicotine products more. This is not only like flavored vaping products, but menthol cigarettes, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so they sued in Franklin County Court, and a Democratic Franklin County judge said, you guys are right, this violates home rule authority. And now this three-judge panel on the Court of Appeals, also in Franklin County, three Democrats said, oh, you guys are right that this violates home rule authority. Mm. Now we have to see if Dave Yost, the attorney general, is going to appeal, but then it would go to the Ohio Supreme Court, which, as I said earlier, is 6-1 Republican. So we'll see if the Republican-led court is as sympathetic as the Democratic-held courts.
And this actually was a provision that they tucked into the last budget, and Governor Mike DeWine had actually vetoed it, but they came back and overrode the veto on this particular language.
Saying that they want
on the tobacco-flavored ban,
okay.
Yes.
Yes, okay. Well, all right. That's another one. We'll have to stay tuned. You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable, and we are here with Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal, Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, and Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service. And Megan, I wanted to move to marijuana because your colleague Morgan Trow wrote about how two House Republicans are fighting to protect access to marijuana. And in the process, they're kind of going up against their own party when it comes to the issue. So it's Representative Jamie Callender, a longtime marijuana proponent, and fellow lawmaker Tex Fisher, who have joined forces recently. They are they're kind of a striking pair. Morgan had had a photo of them. Do they have a big height difference?
They have a big height difference, and
one's tall, one's not so tall. Yeah.
Yes, yes, and also an age difference as well. Mm-hmm. Fisher is the state's youngest lawmaker, who just turned 29, so kind of an unlikely duo, so to speak, even though they are in the same party. But yes, they are trying to fight against essentially what some members of their own party are trying to do when it comes to scaling back marijuana, not access, but some of the provisions that were in the proposed amendment that Ohioans passed back in 2023, and just some lawmakers are trying to add restrictions to them, and so Callender and Fisher are trying to claw back and remove in these bills these restrictions that they would have on marijuana access.
So they are united in wanting to push back on legislative proposals that will restrict what voters voted on, as you just said. So here is Representative Tex Fisher speaking about the 52% of voters who passed that initiated statute.
Thumbing our nose in the face of the voters, I think that should be a non-starter for a lot of people.
And then here is Representative Callender talking to News 5 Cleveland, commenting on why the House GOP, with its 65 members, couldn't reach a 50 yes vote.
Those who are leaning no have varied reasons why they're leaning no, from I don't want to vote for any bill that has the word cannabis in it, to it restricts too much.
So, Megan, basically, are lawmakers, they want to do something here on marijuana, and they just can't all agree?
That's correct, yes. Stemming from how the taxes are going to be distributed to marijuana, to how much THC is in marijuana, as well as to how many plants Ohioans can grow. These are all some big sticking points that lawmakers at one point or another have either put forward legislation about changing, or have discussed how they want to see changes that are made to the marijuana law.
And Governor DeWine has been pushing for Delta 8 products to be off limits for minors as well. Was there any progress when it comes to the budget or any other bill when it comes to Delta 8?
There was talk about that being included, but they ended up not being able to find agreement between the House and the Senate, so they kicked that to later. And so we'll see what they do.
Is Delta 8 hemp? Is that, or is it that different?
I believe it's called intoxicating hemp is the term they use.
Okay.
Yeah, they were pushing hard towards the end before they finished the budget and go on their summer break to try and get some kind of agreement that they were put on the floor before they left for summer break, but they just couldn't come to a consensus.
Was there anything related to marijuana in the budget, or did it all get pulled out?
Yeah, something significant, actually. It changed how marijuana tax revenue from the state is spent. Mm. Up until now, under what voters passed in 2023, the money was spent. It was divvied up between local governments, a social justice fund, and that was designed to help disadvantaged communities get involved in the marijuana industry. There was something to fight addiction and then some administrative costs. Now, under the budget, that's now rewritten. So the local governments that got 36% of the money before, they'll still get their 36%, but the rest of the money, all that other stuff, now is just going to straight go to the state's general revenue fund.
Oh, I thought I remember talking on a roundtable like a long time ago when the budget first came out that all that got pulled out of it. Did it get put back in?
My understanding is it's back in.
Yeah.
And they passed it.
All right. Well, I did not know that. Okay. So basically the local governments got what they wanted. They get to keep their portion. But the way all of the rest of this went, it just goes into the general revenue fund and now lawmakers can use it for whatever.
The budget does a lot of tax cuts and a lot of reversions to the general revenue fund, in part to pay for the Senate's income tax cut. It's a $1 billion income tax cut, again, for people making at least $100,000 per year. And I don't know how much of a direct line you can draw to that, but this budget has a theme of taking a lot of money from a lot of different pools and putting it into the state's general revenue fund.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about school funding. We have some election news. We can maybe even discuss the new Superman movie. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides in the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Still with us, Jeremy Pelzer, Chief Politics Reporter at Cleveland.com, Megan Henry, reporter at the Ohio Capital Journal, and Shane Stegmiller, reporter at Hannah News Service. And Megan, I wanted to go to a story that you wrote about the status of rural hospitals in Ohio under President Trump's spending bill. So what hospitals are we talking about here when it comes to what's happening with rural hospitals and the decisions that were made at the federal level?
Yeah, so it's concerning 11 rural hospitals kind of all throughout Ohio and counties such as Scioto, Coshocton, Harrison, Crawford, and others are across Ohio. Essentially, there was this letter that Democratic senators put forward while the bill was still going through the process of these hospitals, not only in Ohio, but also nationwide. There are more than 300 hospitals included on this list nationwide that were considered at risk for either closure or consolidating and cutting back services. And so now that the Trump's
big, beautiful bill.
Yes, has been signed into law. It's kind of a question now of like, okay, well, what will happen with these 11 hospitals? When I reached out to them, most did not get back to me, but Those that did either decline to comment or say they do not plan to close or change their services. So I guess it's kind of a wait and see what will happen to these hospitals.
And is it because rural hospitals rely so much on Medicaid funding? That's what we're talking about.
Correct.
Here. Okay. So the U.S. senators made this list of 300 hospitals nationwide, and then you just like honed in on that you found 11 of them were in Ohio.
Yes, yes. They used some data from the University of North Carolina put forward, and they broke it down by state. And so, yes, different hospitals just across the state connected to various health service, hospital services, hospital systems.
I wanted to jump to some election news. WOSU's George Shilcock interviewed Congresswoman Joyce Beatty last week. They talked about her recent surgery, her health issues, and her future plans. The 75-year-old Democratic Congresswoman confirmed that she does plan to run again.
I think that my district and my country needs me more now than ever. I have a strong voice in the halls of Congress. I'm respected. So I say this has only prepared me to dig in deeper and fight more, because that's what we need right now. We need people who are experienced. We need people who have a history of not being afraid, whether it is Donald Trump, whether it is the Republicans who are standing in the way of my constituents. I'll be there fighting for them.
Now, Jeremy, in the interview with George, she seemed a little taken aback that George even asked her if she was considering not running because of her age and her health. What do you make of this idea? I mean, she's 75. She missed a key vote because she had to have hip surgery. And then she went to another vote right after having eye surgery. So George just asked her if she was going to not run again. Does that surprise you that she seemed taken aback by the question?
I guess I'm not surprised that that was her response to a reporter, but the scrutiny is not coming out of nowhere. Like you said, she missed a key vote, and her office for a while just said, oh, well, she had a medical procedure, and didn't give any more details for a while about what that meant. And finally, she showed up at this Democratic press conference about the big, beautiful bill, wearing an eye patch in a wheelchair. And so that raises, I think, legitimate questions about what her future political plans are. If she, another reason is that she holds and has held a very Democratic district. Mm-hmm. And the way it's going with redistricting, one of the few reliably Democratic districts in Ohio. And if she leaves, there's going to be a whole slew of Democrats who are going to be fighting to take over her seat when she leaves. So I guess I'm not surprised that she's going to say, hey, everything's fine. I don't know why you guys are making such a fuss, but I also don't think it's surprising that people are raising questions and working behind the scenes to say, hey, when she leaves, maybe I could take over that seat.
Well, do you think that she could have a primary challenger? I mean, that's not unheard of. Someone could run against her.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. The question is whether that primary challenger would have significant backing and support. Mm-hmm. My guess is, given the power that Joyce Beatty has within the Franklin County Democratic Party, that I don't think she would get seriously primaried. But if there's if that potential opponent could win over people saying, hey, Joyce Beatty, for whatever reason, isn't the best representative that we could have because of, say, his health concerns, I guess, you know, that wouldn't be super shocking.
And do we know if with redistricting, will her district stay the same?
It will change a little bit. I would expect it to change a little bit. It's still going to be safely Democratic because it's going to be really hard to draw, you know, two or three Franklin County Republican seats without violating the rules that are pretty clear in the Ohio Constitution on how you can split counties and townships and cities and all of that. Mm.
And I mean, not to be ageist here, but as Jeremy said, there is pushback nationally against not just Joyce Beatty, but candidates who have served for many, many years. There's criticism of them holding onto their seats and that we're not building up the next generation of leaders. So does this also raise the question of, again, I don't like term limits or age limits and that whole thing? Because, I mean, at least here in Ohio, we've kind of put some parameters on certain things.
I think it definitely can raise the conversation, the question of should there be term limits in Congress. As you mentioned, in Ohio, the state house, there are limits. So I think it, again, just raises the question of should there be term limits or age limits when it comes to people who have been in office for a long time.
Yeah, in Ohio, we figured out how to dance around the term limits, right, by bouncing back and forth between the House and the Senate. Is that so I guess, you know, there's the Congress could do the same thing, right?
It's a little harder because there's only two U.S. Senate seats instead of 33.
Yeah.
Joyce Beatty's also only been in Congress since 2012, 2013. So it's not,
she hasn't been there for 50 years. Yeah.
She's not Marcy Kaptur, who's been there since 80. You know, she's not some of these other ones who've been there a long time.
Well, you're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. With us, Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service, Jeremy Pelzer from Cleveland.com, and Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal. And Megan, you wrote you were continuing on the topic of we talked about federal funding cuts a moment ago, and you wrote about what federal funding cuts are meaning for research funding when it comes to Ohio's colleges and universities. Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned about federal cuts impacting universities?
Yes, it could definitely impact Ohio colleges and universities. I talked specifically to Ohio State University and some folks in their astronomy department, and they said that proposed cuts that were in the federal budget that at the time, the bill had not passed, but it has now, of course, passed. And so we'll see what kind of happens with this funding. But basically, the Ohio State, for an example, the Ohio State Astronomy Department has 30 grad students, and slightly more than half of them are funded through federal grants that were on the chopping block and saw some of it, some of these grants, these funds be cut. So that could significantly impact Ohio State University. Also, some of the research they do, they are heavily involved in a NASA, the upcoming flagship mission for NASA. And so that could be just either delayed or significantly halted. And Ohio State has played a pivotal role in helping getting that ready to launch, which is set it's called the Nancy Grace Roman Spaceship Telescope. And it's set to launch next October, 2026. And so that could now be significantly delayed because of this.
Yeah, and that's just astronomy. I'm sure there's many other departments too. Yes. And Jeremy, your colleague Laura Hancock reported that there was nearly $185 million funded through the federal government that has not been dispersed to K-12 schools as well. It was scheduled to be dispersed back on July 1st. That's a lot of money missing from schools. If you can't talk about it, we'll talk to Laura next time she's
happy
on.
To.
Yeah, go ahead.
Happy to.
So it's $185 million that was supposed to, from the federal government, that was supposed to go to K-12 schools, and it didn't get sent out. Yeah.
Right. And it's under review, so we'll see what happens with it. This is certainly not the first time the Trump administration has put federal funding for various things on hold as it does reviews. This money would disproportionately affect districts serving low-income students, English learners, students with disabilities. This includes about $1 million for migrant education, about $77 million for professional development for teachers, $30 million for teaching English, and $46 million for a federal after-school program. So again, this money is going to be on hold, and we'll see what ends up happening, what they finally decide, ultimately decide. This isn't just for Ohio. Like, these programs, these funds are on hold in all 50 states. This is just Ohio's share of the money.
Mm-hmm. And before we run out of time, another story that you wrote, Jeremy, that I wanted to flag is here in Ohio, there's an interesting race developing for the state Supreme Court. So, Jeremy, you've been covering that. Do you want to bring us up to speed on the little bit of turf war that's happening at the Supreme Court? Yeah, you mentioned several times during this hour that there's 6 Republicans and 1 Democrat on that court, but
there's 1 Democrat on the court. And it's the 1 Democrat still holding statewide office in Ohio, and it's Jennifer Bruner, who's a former Ohio Secretary of State from Columbus. And as there's only 1 Democrat, as you can imagine, there's a whole slew of Republicans who are in some sort of feeding frenzy to try to get the nomination to run against her. And there were already 4 Republicans in the race to run against her. You had 2 appeals court justices. You had Andrew King of Granville, Ron Lewis from outside Xenia. You also had a Rocky River Municipal Court judge named Joseph Burke, and then a former Franklin County Common Pleas judge named Colleen O'Donnell. But then this race was shaken up.
I'm losing count. I was trying to count.
So that's four. Okay. But then you have a fifth. This, and the big one was that a current Ohio Supreme Court justice, Pat Fisher from Cincinnati, announced in the middle of his term he's going to switch and run against Bruner. And this is the first time, apparently, this has ever happened, that a justice in the middle of his term decided to run for another Supreme Court seat. And
but he's playing a shell game with that, because that has to do with his age, right? Isn't he?
Part of the criticism about this is that if he, because Ohio is, we were talking about term limits.
Yeah.
Ohio has a judicial age limit that if you're 70 years or older, you can't run for a judge or a justice. Mm-hmm. And if when his term is up in 2028, he'll be 70. But if he runs next year, he won't be 70. And then he could serve a full 6-year term. So that's part of the thing about this. But the wrinkle is that when he entered the race, these other four people said, oh, we're not leaving. we're going to keep running. I talked to former Ohio Senate President Larry Obhoff, who's we may have a sixth Republican jumping in. He's thinking about it. The upshot is this will get winnowed down because the Ohio Republican Party is going to have an endorsement process coming up starting next month. And in early September, they can announce who to endorse. Pat Fisher and a couple of the others said that if they don't get the endorsement, they will drop out of the race. And even if they don't drop out of the race, you know, the state party endorsee will get a significant leg up over the others. But there's a real chance now that the Ohio Republican Party will have its first contested Supreme Court primary since 2016, with which actually Pat Fisher won.
Hmm. All right, so when I'm getting 2025 and 2026 mixed up, when is this primary going to be?
May 2026.
Okay.
So endorsement process comes out in September. Primary election is in May, and then the general election against Bruner will be in November of next year.
All right. So I guess we'll stay tuned on that. But right now there's five or six running against.
There's five and possibly a sixth.
Possibly a sixth. All right.
And maybe even more. Who knows?
Yes. What, you made a nice graphic with the pictures. I don't know if you made it, but I saw in your story about this, you had all of the faces of them all lined up.
I did. Any more jump in, I'll have to create a Brady Bunch style grid.
Right. Yeah. To fit them all their pictures into the grid. Okay, so I wanted to just jump to real quick. Lieutenant Governor Jim Tressel has announced an initiative that he wants to make Ohio healthier. But so far he hasn't said that he's running for governor. So what does Jim Tressel want to do to make Ohio healthier? Did anyone write about his plan? No one. Oh, I'm getting silence. Well, no one wants Ohio to be healthier. They just want Jim Tressel to run for governor.
I mean, his announcement comes after Vivek Ramaswamy, who's the front runner to be governor and has actually jumped in the race, issued his call to restore the presidential fitness test. So this is widely seen as the DeWine administration's answer to that, to maybe preempt that.
Does Jim Tressel want to make his own fitness test, or does he want to bring back the presidential one?
He said, Ohio schools, get ready. Fitness test is coming. I don't know if he's released the details of that. He said he called it a fitness challenge.
Are we going to have to climb a rope? Not me, but my poor kids.
I was going to say, I don't know if it's mandatory for everyone in Ohio or just students.
If anyone remembers the reaching box.
Sit and reach. Yeah, I was good at the sit and reach, just not the rope or the pull-ups. All right. Well, I guess we'll just wait and see if anyone has to climb a rope. I'll report back if my kids have to, though, because they will not be happy. Well, then speaking of Vivek Ramaswamy, the Ohio Republican Party sent out on X, they tweeted out a state map that was all red, and it said 480 days until Vivek Ramaswamy carries all 88 counties in Ohio as the next governor. Is that even possible for him to win all 88 counties?
Of course, it's possible. No Ohio governor has ever won all 88 counties in a general election. The closest we've come to that was when Jim Rhodes won 87 counties in 1966. Pike County was the lone holdout.
Look at you with all this historic knowledge.
I was checking it out on Friday because I'm nerding out over it. John Kasich won 86 counties in 2014 over at Fitzgerald. So it's certainly possible, but it is rather ambitious. suspicious, especially in places like Athens County, which do or die tends to vote Democratic just in just about every election year.
Shane, what did you make? Did you see that picture of the red map? It was striking. It made me pause in my doom scrolling.
Yes, yes, I saw that as well, and I had to have a chuckle because it's red.
It was a red map of Ohio.
It's kind of braggadocious, you know.
Braggadocious. Good word.
Yes. But I mean, it's the goal. I mean, when you're putting together a campaign, you always want to try and win every county, and Ohio has gone much further red. So I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility, but there's also these little pockets of blue that are getting a little more stubborn, such as Franklin County, such as Athens County, Cuyahoga County, even Hamilton County is becoming slowly more blue when it used to be a reliably red county.
And obviously it depends who the Democratic nominee is. I mean, Babette goes in being seen as the favorite to win. Right now there's only Amy Acton in the Democratic race.
If she doesn't draw out enough people to vote for her, then
then we could have, the Republican feeling is we could have a John Kasich situation when he only won Athens and Monroe counties, and even Franklin and Cuyahoga were won by the Republicans that year, and that was less than a decade.
All right, well, we'll have to save our discussion of the Superman movie and playing I Spy Cleveland in that for the next time. I want to say thank you. Thank you, Jeremy Pelzer, chief politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks.
Megan Henry, reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Thanks, Shane.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for using braggadocious, too. And this is the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.